sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China economy is still slowing, but stimulus measures seem to be on the way. Women are still spending, and we got some stocks to watch on that. And we got to stay tuned this week for more Fed speak. All this and much more on episode number 279 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, what do you know? All the way to September 10th, 2012. And we are going to be talking about some important things today because we did see a lot of things out of China. We saw some really rough numbers last week out of Europe. Some good earnings coming out of the U.S., some employment that's been kind of, disappointing at best. And we're beyond the conventions, Republican and Democratic, and the showmanship, the rah-rah rallies, and all that goes on. And we're heading into the real hardcore stretch where usually in the past years ago, way in the past years ago, we've seen where we see all the different wonderful things that each of the candidates can bring to the occasion and the economy and the people and jobs and the wondrous things they'll do. But this time it seems that we're going to see something quite the opposite, pretty much a slug'em match, a rock'em sock'em robot match, where each of the other is going to try to knock the head off the other candidate with all sorts of smear tactics. And it's just getting so disgusting that it's hard to even understand who's telling the truth anymore. I don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, or whatever you may be. The fact is that they're making it very difficult for us to understand what their platforms are, because their platforms are nothing more than saying the other guy stinks. I don't know how you get along with that, but it's kind of difficult to really even stomach much more of this. I do want to mention that this show, this is important, is dedicated to Fred Safer, my grandfather, who passed this week on Friday. He was 93 years old, had a wonderful life. He had one of those great long lives where just passed peacefully on Friday. And he taught me some amazing things. He was a big influence on me in the financial business and taught me things like how to enjoy sushi back in, 1984, before it was in vogue to do so. You know what's really cool? We put together a video back in 2004, and we spent time going over his life, doing kind of a biography. And I encourage you to take a look at it, because it may be something that you can do in your family. So many times we forget about the people, what they've done, or maybe even the grandkids, great-grandkids, they just don't know about the lives that they had of our elders and our parents and our grandparents. And what we did was we put together a video. It's about 30 minutes, and it kind of goes through the beginnings of his life through the end, and he spoke of it himself. I put it on the site for you to take a look at. We uploaded it to YouTube. It's in the Sunday area of thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And the reason I'm telling you this is because if you have a camera these days and a little bit of artistic talent when it comes to videography and video making, and even if you don't, it's not that hard to just sit a parent or a grandparent in front of a camera and just say, hey, tell me about your life, because it's worth remembering. And if you can do so in the age of technology like we have today, and it makes it so easy to do so, in the future, one day, you never know when, be great to watch. All of our family has watched it, and when I sent it to them separately, and now we just put it up on YouTube so that more people that knew him can find out a little bit more about my grandfather. Papa Freddy, we called him. And, I'm 47 years old, and I had my grandfather with me all these years and guiding me and helping me and teaching me, and it's a wonderful thing. So anybody who's interested in that, I really encourage you to take a look at that. So we're going to dedicate the show to Papa Freddy, okay? Well, everybody raise a little glass. He likes scotch. So raise a glass of scotch maybe and, say a little hello to Papa Freddy for me. All right, so what's going on in China? I mean, China is really slowing down pretty significantly. We came out with numbers over the weekend that saw that industrial production was down and actually missed estimates, and it's down to about 10%, whereas it was about, I don't know, 14% recently. And it's starting to really get kind of murky, where we saw exports recently at 1%. If you remember, we talked about that a couple of weeks back, where exports were expected to come in somewhere in the 7% range. And at the same time, we kind of got confronted with the fact that, man, things are really slowing off a lot more than anticipated. A lot of talk about stimulus, and China did come out with some stimulus, but they need to be careful because their CPI is still running a little bit, just a little bit hot. So there's this balancing act that's going on right now. They want to make sure that the banks are really structured well so they don't have a significant amount of bad loans. They want to make sure at the same time that they have an economy that's growing, but also they're trying to spur domestic demand. So they've kind of changed around the valuation of the currency. And at the same time, they're getting hit from all corners of a slowdown, and particularly from Europe. They're in a very different situation where they've on a trend down, where the United States, for example, is on a tread steady. Europe's trending down, emerging markets somewhat trending down, China's trending down. So a lot of talk about stimulus. Now, already you know my commentary on the whole idea of stimulus. The amount of stimulus talk that's been going on, and you have to wonder who's leading who. Is it the press, the media, the investors that are leading the principals at the countries that are making decisions? Is it kind of like, have they become beholden for the election vote that may be coming one day in some of these countries, that they hope that, hey, you know what, we have more stimulus coming, and that's going to cement our election? Is it more so that the central banks are really looking at markets more than economies right now? Now, China did put out some stimulus. They've been kind of just slowly but surely leaking out a little bit here, a little bit there, turning on the spigot ever so softly. They did, in fact, do something last week. We saw their markets up 3, 4, 5%, depending on what Asian market, on Friday. And the reason for that was for the hopeful fact that there's going to be stimulus in China, stimulus in America coming out next week, theoretically, and the fact that Draghi has done the bazooka by doing unlimited bond purchases on under 3-year bonds, and hopefully that's going to fly and do well, etc., because we have something coming up from Germany this week, which we're going to talk about in a moment. Now, at the same time, when China did unleash just about $150-160 billion worth of infrastructure growth initiatives, where they're going to be expanding the railroads, subways, and some streets, they also put a small initiative out where they're going to give incentives for, energy efficient electronics. So, for example, for fans and different types of heating units, and maybe for energy-efficient computers, they're going to be giving subsidies and benefits to. Now, this could be interesting because what we saw last week when we heard the announcement that there was going to be a stimulus package that is going to be focused on infrastructure, well, we saw the steel companies, the cement companies, railroad companies really do very, very well. Whether or not that is going to be short-lived or something that holds is another matter entirely. But we did see that many of the stocks, like even in America, you know, you get your Cliffs, your U.S. Steel, AK Steel, you see the cement companies around the world really did extremely well. Now, there's so much short interest in these, and they have been downgraded and they have been just pummeled, these stocks, that, you know what, they're coming off the bottom here. And when they come off the bottom, oftentimes there's a big move. You've seen this before, where you've seen things that are just been hammered away and hammered away, and you get to a point that it's almost exhaustion, where there's just not much more selling to go on. So what happens when any buying does in fact happen? Two things happen. First, you see that when buyers step in and there's no sellers, well, you get that kind of instant move up. But the second thing is that the short sellers, the people that are short the shares, say, hey, you know what? Maybe it's time to get out of some of this. So you have to look at this as an opportunity to, and it's probably not going to be a single day, I don't think, as we saw just last week, because we finally saw a lot of downgrades, the final downgrades of many of these stocks, and people saying these are really going to be horrible. because of a slowdown around the world. But if China does come in and put down $150 billion stimulus package, remember, their original stimulus package back in 2008 was only for $550 billion. And that, look what that did to their market. Look what that did to the commodity space. We already saw gold popping over 1,700 an ounce. We saw silver up something like 10% last week or even more than that. We saw the entire commodity market move, and copper, which is a great, you know, they call it Dr. Copper. This is the internal view of the potential for markets and the health of economies. We saw that finally start to move up last week and moved up very smartly after this announcement. And we already know that China has a lot of commodities that they have, you know, in inventory. They really did a lot of bulking up of their overall commodity inventory for some time. They slowed down for a while, and that's why we saw many of these commodities across the board really move lower. At the same time, you have to realize when they do come out with a stimulus package and they do come out with money that they are earmarking for a some kind of infrastructure build, for example, which a lot of people doubted, by the way. They doubted that China would do this because they're afraid that there's going to be a lot of inflation. But here's the thing. If China comes out with a very refined and targeted, and they talk about this, that they're going to use fine-tuning. So instead of coming out with a blanket stimulus plan, if they come out with a very finely tuned, hey, we're going to do subways and railroads, well, kind of calculate what subways and railroads need in terms of materials. Again, you got cement, you have steel, maybe copper for some of that, you know. And you kind of go down the list of what they would need there. That could be an interesting sector that would really come along very well. And usually what happens is the entire sector starts moving. You know, whether or not you see, for example, AK Steel, which really is involved in more of the automobile area, you know, they start moving and continue moving. And what does that really have to do with China infrastructure? Because they have their own steel companies, et cetera. Well, it just gets a lift along with the rest of them. And because of the high level of short interest on much of this, you got to watch these names. So kind of take a look at the materials and watch them and see where you're going to find a breakout, you know, in the Cliffs, which is CLF, X, U.S. Steel, AKS, AK Steel, the international, like a Cemex, international cement companies overall, China Steel. Look at these companies, and even the ones from Brazil. They have a good relationship with Brazil, and there's a few of them you can find there. Girdo is a steel company that does the, what's the best way to describe this? They do the rebar steel. So if you have, it's more for bridges and things like that. But again, you know, if they're going to build tunnels and they're going to be doing that, they need the rebar to really make the roofing and the entire tunnel and the, you know, the various poles that hold up the tunnel and the security of it. Assuming they, you know, are going to go that route, they're going to possibly go that route and use them. And you got to look at these stocks because they've been really pummeled and obliterated at best. That's being kind to what's happened recently. So take a look at those. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put up maybe a short list. I'm going to do what's called a screen. We do these screens in here, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to put a screen of China infrastructure plays. And just for you to take a look at, I'll put a list of stocks up on the show notes of this particular podcast, which is episode number 279, okay? Take a look at that over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Stimulus has been the word of the day, week, year. Last 2 years has been kind of an overbearing amount of stimulus, pushing and manipulating by central banks. We've seen the currencies moving all over the place. We saw the euro pop over 128 on Friday after the U.S. unemployment rate came out. The unemployment rate actually came out, the headline number, 8.1%, which is like hip, hip, hooray, hoorah. Everybody's all excited about it. But did you interestingly notice that President Obama did not play it up? Kind of interesting, I thought. You know, why isn't he playing up this unemployment number? The reality is because the dirty little secret is out about how the unemployment rate is actually moving and why it's getting better. Most analysts expected an 8.3% number, but 8.1 came out. Why? Well, we had another significant drop in the labor participation rate, meaning less people are in the workforce. And when less people are in the workforce and we see a drop like that, and what you see is a commensurate drop in the unemployment rate. If you were to add back the number of people that are actually not discouraged and not leaving the workforce, you'd probably be somewhere close to a 10% unemployment rate. And I think President Obama did a smart thing from a political sense in that he didn't play it up, because probably what would have happened, he would have gotten thrown, you know, as they do in volleyball, he would have got stuffed. So I think that's probably why they didn't play it up too much at the White House. And you didn't see a lot of, you know, excitement about that. But what we did see is a lot of news items saying, hey, unemployment rate at 8.1, but for the wrong reasons. Take a look around the web. You'll see a lot of things that talk about that. And I think that was very important to look at, and a very good recognition that finally there's a realization that, you know what, the unemployment situation is not as good as it looks. Clearly over 8% is not good anyway, right? We all agree with that. 8% is not a good number. Over 8%. Over 7% isn't a good number. But as I'm sitting here right now telling you something, I've said this a long time ago, and I'm going to tell you again now, we have a structural unemployment problem, and it is really kind of, it's sad that the Fed won't admit to it. They won't admit to it because, you know, the fact of the matter is that if they do so, it's going to scare people. It's going to discourage more people from going back to work. And the Fed's objective, obviously, is the ultimate cheerleader for the markets and for the economy, whether it's the Fed here or it's, you know, if you look around the world. So we have this structural unemployment problem, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, because of the fact of technology, because of reengineering, because of efficiencies, and because of robotics and automation. If you think about it, there's an entire cadre, an entire genre of jobs that is just not going to be replaced and added back to our economy. Think about all the different things that you can do with automation these days. Think about, you know, basic, I don't know, quote unquote, secretarial jobs that just don't need to happen because you have word processors. Think about, we talked about how, you know, FedEx may be guiding lower and some other, like the post office is losing money because you don't really have to have letters anymore. You can have digital documents. You know, think about just, you know, even as crazy as it is, the iRobot, and you don't have to have a vacuum cleaner anymore. Think about your pool where you have the Barracuda that's cleaning the bottom of it. You don't need possibly a service to come in anymore and someone to actually do a vacuuming of a pool. Who knows if one day we have driverless cars? Just kind of think through this for a little while and think about the reasonable level of what I'm saying. The rational thought here is that we have a structural problem. It's not only due to monetary policy. It's not due to any kind of law issues. It's not due to anything, even outsourcing. It's just a fact of the growth and the maturity of our technology, efficiencies, etc. And companies are paid to be more efficient. And as such, you're going to see the continuation of that sector in technology growing nicely because they are continually trying to come up with new innovation to find greater efficiency, which then yields greater profitability for companies. Think about it, and it makes all the sense in the world. Now, where are some areas that you're not going to see that? Well, probably for a long time at least, you're not going to see that in the healthcare area. So I tell my daughters, by the way, who are in the fourth year of college, one of them is going to graduate school or looking to go to graduate school next year, and they ask me, Dad, where should I be looking for a job? I said, you know, there's a couple of different things. First of all, you have to do what you love. You have to do what you like, you know, and you'll be successful at it. Do what you really are passionate about. Okay, great. But Dad, I want to make sure that I can make a living. So I said, you know what? I got to tell you, one of the best places I could think of is healthcare. And I mean, you probably thought of that too. You probably realized that too. We have an aging population here and around the world, many places around developed nations. And healthcare is a necessity. You know, I say one of the best jobs in the world, if you think about it, for job security is to be an orthopedist. Why? Well, in a way, if you're an oncologist, possibly, maybe, hopefully, one day, cancer is eradicated by some kind of new vaccine, drug, some kind of therapy. Maybe heart attacks will be eradicated somehow. But you know what? People are going to fall down. They're going to get into accidents. Things are going to happen. You need an orthopedist. Bones break. It's how it is. I don't know if there's going to be a cure for that one day, maybe by some mega calcium supplement or something. I don't know. But the fact is that accidents happen. So if you want to think about it, where do you want to have the greatest job security? I said, you know, you want to probably be in the healthcare area because for not right now, for the foreseeable future, especially with the baby boom generation, healthcare is great. Now let's segue back to the podcast here for a second, back to the disciplined investor, back to investing. Let's segue back to, well, where do we go with that? Well, you have drug companies, whether it's going to be biotechs, whether it's going to be generic replacements, whether it's going to be companies that are in the name brand, whether it's going to be maybe hospitals. You know, that whole area of healthcare is a really good place to play. Now, they'll cycle just like any other sector, but there's a lot of stocks, Alexion, Perrigo. Look at these stocks and where they've been. You know, there's some specialty companies that you need to be looking at, like Spectrum Pharma. Look at, you know, talking about the whole idea of orthopedics. Where else is a good place? Well, if vanity continues to be a fact of life over time, possibly orthodontics. And there's a company called Align Technology, hit a new high last week. They make the Invisalign. And as I speculated some time ago, I think that if we see the company go overseas, particularly into Japan and China and Asia, there's going to be just a tremendous opportunity for them. And, you know, they have. So when you look at the whole area of healthcare, think about the longevity of that particular trade, that particular opportunity, with the fact that you have people aging and the need for all sorts of care, whether it's long-term care, nursing care, even hospice, or just even the area of the drugs to treat a variety of the diseases. And, you know, many of these are going to require people to do it. Now, pharmacists, not a great place because, you know what, the old days of pharmacists where they would mix the drugs together and then they would pound it together with a mortar and pestle, and that's not there anymore. In fact, much of the pharmaceutical companies right now, pharmacists are kind of getting much more automated. If you've been to a Walgreens or a CVS or wherever you buy your particular pharmacies, have you noticed the incredible change where they have these machines to dispense exact counts, all automated? It's much healthier because now they're no longer mixing the pills in the same pan that they're mixing other pills on. There's no cross-contamination issues. The count issues are much better. There's a cross-reference to make sure that allergies and people taking certain drugs aren't mixed with other drugs. And, of course, the theft issue. You eliminate the people. Eliminate the people, you eliminate the benefits for the people. Eliminate all that cost factors for the people. Eliminate a lot of the mistakes. Sure, computers make mistakes. Automation makes mistakes. But you know what? Probably, if it's programmed correctly, aside from the recent situation we saw in the markets when some of the programming algorithms went a little snafu on us, fact is that, again, automation is taking over. Look what Amazon does. Amazon, you know, you maybe had the box pickers and packers and wrappers and then senders, and now you have a lot of that done by automation because you have the ability to scan the box, pull the box with the robot, put it into a line, wrap it, send it, and then send it off through whatever mail service you have. So again, I mean, look at some of the longevity plays right now in the market because the market's kind of getting towards the top end of a what I would say would be a valuation level, somewhere probably between the give or take 1375 to 1460 or so is kind of a valuation metric, not a trading metric, taking away excess liquidity by the Fed and all the stimulus and all that. That's where the valuation probably, wide range, but that's where the valuation probably is, probably a little bit lower than we are right now from a market standpoint. But at the same time, if you think about the healthcare opportunity, I think it's pretty dramatic. So we have the stimulus that's going on in China. We have the healthcare that's going to be a long-term trade probably in the U.S. Technology also that's going to aid and assist all of that. Okay, good stuff, right? All right, let's move on now to what's happening in markets. Finally, we're seeing September comes along, and we have not only the prospect of stimulus and all that, but volume is coming into the market. Market was kind of dead in terms of volume in end of July through August in general, on average. There was a couple of days here and there, but, I mean, really just a lack of anything going on, and there was the opportunity for markets to move all over the place. Well, about, Wednesday, all of a sudden volume started coming in. There was big volume on Thursday with that big move, and we saw some decent volume again across the board, not only in the U.S., but around the world. We saw some great volume in the markets. And that's a good sign that there's a lot more institutions putting money to work. And I think that's a very important issue that we need to focus on, because you want to play the way the institutions are playing. And right now, a lot of institutions are, and particularly in hedge funds, are kind of behind the eight ball. All right, that's fine. You know, it was kind of a wonky year. The first part of the year was really good, and then all of a sudden things got a little bit crazy in the second quarter, and then all of a sudden you got this snapback. But the bottom line is that when institutions start playing, they could really start moving things up, in particular from a low-volume environment into the next stage of the market. So we have to watch carefully what the volume trends are going to be telling us, because now we're going to get a much truer sense of what the market is saying rather than what happened probably through, I would say, the summertime. Summertime could have been moved around very much through algorithmic trading, high-frequency trading, and futures and ETF-driven trading. Barry Ritholtz was recently on Bloomberg, and I saw a video that he did last week. Barry Ritholtz from the Big Picture blog, ritholtz.com, and I think that his commentary was, he talked about three different things that were moving markets, and he talked about how the two main issues were the high-frequency trading and that we're bouncing things back and forth, computers kind of whacking each other back and forth throughout the summer on the low-volume trading. So retail investors kind of were like, hands off, they're not invested. We saw a lot of money come out of stock funds into bond funds on a consistent basis over the last 12 to 18 months and plus, which is interesting. But also at the same time, volumes were benign at best. The second thing was the euphoria and the excitement about the stimulus packages, because we saw in the last couple of years that markets moved over dramatically higher, at least in a bumpy nature or directionally higher straight up, when we saw the QE1, QE2, the Operation Twist, Jackson Hole. And right now, there's a big hope that something's going to happen actually this week. We have the FOMC meeting this week. And if you look back on the data that we saw recently, we saw a very disappointing manufacturing number that was actually in the contraction zone again for 3 months. Third month in a row that manufacturing contracted. At the same time, the service numbers are actually holding up pretty strong. And I think that's a good thing. I think that, and you look at manufacturing and looking at exports, the high dollar, that's a problem, because when you see a high dollar or a dollar that's been moving up in value, the probability is that our manufacturing, where we do a lot of export, or at least some export, is going to be a little bit soft. And you combine that with the fact that Europe is just, kind of not buying. Well, what you have is a combination for manufacturing slowdown. We actually saw the jobs number on Friday, a drop of 10,000 in the manufacturing sector. So there's confirmation across the board that manufacturing is slowing down. Now, at the same time, what we did see was that the service numbers, the ISM non-manufacturing numbers, held up pretty darn well. Again, showing the resilience of the consumer in the United States, the opportunity for them to go out, even though there's flat wage growth. In the face of that, they're going out, they're buying things, they're going to restaurants, and actually the service sectors overall are doing just fine. I'll take a 53. In this kind of environment where we're seeing a drop-off across the board everywhere else, I'll take a good service number that's above the contraction in the expansionary zone. We saw the same thing actually in China. Their service sector did well also. So something's happening in the manufacturing area, probably due to the fact that we see a rise in the inventory to sales ratio. This is when you're looking at, okay, what are the inventories out there? How are they building? And let's take a look at what's selling. And if inventories are rising, we don't know the number alone. We need to see in relationship to what the sales are. So if we're seeing an inventory to sales ratio that is rising, that means that sales are not keeping pace with the rise of inventories. Manufacturers will slow down. They don't want their inventories to get out of whack. They'll slow down and kind of let these sales slowly bleed off the inventories so they're not stuck with any products and have to do major discounting. So I think it's good that we're seeing a good service number. I think it's very concerning that we're seeing a manufacturing slowdown. And on top of that, I believe that the structural unemployment problem is going to continue to show very similar economic trends moving forward. So that brings us to, what is the Fed going to do? They see an unemployment number of 8.1, but they realize that the labor participation rate is low. You see manufacturing slowing down. They see a big bond buying, the bazooka program, being put into place in Europe. They see that China is starting to do a little bit of stimulus. Do they actually embark on the next generation of QE? I got to tell you something. I think the trade-off of what the expectations will be from that in accordance to their primary goal, which is to moderate the pace of inflation and to, you know, keep employment in check at the right number, which is somewhere in the 5% range or so, I would be hard-pressed to say that, yeah, they're going to come out with a gigantic program, because it would seem like that would be their last shot to do so. Their balance sheet is so bloated right now. There is so much dissension about, you know, giving the Fed even more opportunity to buy bonds. Yields are not going to go much lower. And the fact of the matter is, if people aren't buying yet houses and they're not refinancing and they're not spending at the low cost, I don't see where that's going to get them. Better would be to drop the rate on what they pay banks to keep money at the Federal Reserve and force them to take money out and possibly lend it. Better would be, frankly, in my opinion, to not do the QE, let the bond rates go up a little bit, let people say, oh my gosh, I better go buy a house now, because you know what? Rates are getting higher. Now, monitor it so it doesn't go up too much, because they won't want to have the U.S. paying exorbitant prices on the money that they borrowed, right? Or that they have out on their bonds. Because right now the U.S. is enjoying, even though they have $16 trillion of debt outstanding and counting, a very low interest rate environment. The fact is, I think they need to start mopping up some of this, but very slowly. Do it in a way that's very constrained. Can maybe continue with the Operation Twist, but at the same time continue thinking about retiring some bonds. The big discussion is that, hey, the Fed's going to come out with, we're going to keep interest rates low through 2015, not just 2014. And the hope of that is that the markets will say, hey, you know what? They're real serious about keeping this interest rate low. Now, here's the problem. Here's the rub with this. If they do QE, if they come out with another plan of any kind of stimulus, if they pledge to keep interest rates low until 2015 or something of that nature, if in fact they reduce the reserves on the banks, that's probably the reduce the interest rates they pay on bank reserves on deposit, which I think is actually the best solution right now, the best thing to do. The problem is, any of the others are inflationary. Any of the other things they do will actually bring down the value of the dollar, most probably, because they're going to be doing some kind of quantitative easing. Now, if they do the option of Operation Twist, not as much. But if they go into a new round of bond buying, or they do something even more ridiculous, where they're going to be basically printing money, dollar goes down. Dollar goes down, we have more of an increase in commodity prices, which already are pricing in a dramatic move. Clearly, we saw oil price at 97. The gas at the pump is close to $4. Gold, silver moving up. And we see a variety of other commodities, like the food commodities, not only being affected by the drought, but also being affected by speculation that the dollar is going to continue to weaken, or really weaken. Now, the problem with that is that that tips the process of trying to stimulate the economy by monetary policy, at the same time, again, being stuffed by the fact that, hey, prices at the pump are up, costing Americans more. Prices of input are going to go up, costing Americans more. Margins are going to be squeezed because the price of inputs are going up, and that's going to cause corporations to have lower earnings. And you go on and on and on. So there's I got to tell you something. I think probably more so now than we've seen in a long time, the decision by the Fed is one that's very, very difficult. While they want to come at it and go, yeah, let's just go out there and just throw some money at it and, you know, continue with the whole easing process, monetary policy that's going to just really shock the markets and really wake things up and spur on the economy, I think they realize that there's a lot of risk involved in that. A lot of risk of inflation, not at the inflation that's going to be runaway inflation, because we're still in kind of a very low inflationary environment, because we're still filling back the hole that was made by the meltdown of 2008-2009. Housing prices starting to come out back in certain regions, starting to level off. That's good. Sales are still slow of new homes, but okay, it's leveling off. It's not getting worse. But if they start doing some massive quantitative easing at this point, oil prices will go above 100. Food prices will continue to escalate. Input prices across the board because of materials and metals, whether it's copper or zinc or whatever is being used, is going to go up. And while that would be good for exports because the lower dollar does help the exports of companies, I think you're going to have a margin compression. That's a big problem. We already saw gold and silver spiking because of this. So I think that's a big issue that needs to be dealt with. The good news is that, again, we're seeing the service sector and some other areas do very well. We're seeing women still buying. Still buying. Even though in the face of the higher unemployment rate and wages that are flat, we're seeing companies like Lululemon, Ulta, Salon, which, you know, the makeup and fragrance and women's clothing doing very well. Matter of fact, there was a big concern that Lululemon was going to really have a problem. Shorts were in there pretty hard. Stock comes out with earnings, did pretty good on their guidance, and it was up about 10% on Friday, and Ulta was up about 6.5%. And if you look at the charts there, they're doing pretty darn well. Variety of other companies as well, some apparel companies doing well, but you know, it's really interesting that the higher end and the certain ones that everybody had a lot of doubts at, because last quarter they came out with, you know, kind of a squishy number, really doing well. Stocks that are pretty impressive, as a matter of fact. The growth stocks have really been once again leading, and it's pretty impressive that many of these growth stocks that were kind of taken to the cleaners a little bit during each of the down cycles of the last year and a half have really come back very strong, showing that they really know how to earn in a very difficult environment. And that is a sign of good management and a sign of a good investment that you want to be involved with. We're going to be doing a write-up of what I call the Fab Five, something that Bloomberg and Joseph Bruzuelas has done, of looking at jewelry, restaurants, looking at women's apparel, looking at women's fragrance, looking at a variety of five different components that make up this really important sector of spending, and find out kind of what that's doing. We're going to have that in our next quarterly update for our clients, and we'll send that out to everybody. Let's give a quick talk about, it's a little bit different. we're going to get back to some issues when it comes to the what's going to be happening next week. But, you know, let's give a little, I think, an important discussion about what's going to be happening this week. So we got the FOMC coming out, but also on the 12th, two things happening, two things that are totally different than the other, but very market moving. I guess we'll start with Germany. Germany's coming out with a vote to see whether or not it is a legal, they are legally allowed to be utilizing monies from Germany to fund the Emergency Financial Stability Fund, and maybe even the ESM in Europe. This is going to be a constitutional vote that is going to be released on the 12th. Now, already they've set it up that they're going to be buying bonds on an unlimited fashion, 3 years and under, so that basically they can kind of come under the radar of some of the things that would happen if, in fact, Germany put the kibosh on. Now, if Germany does put the kibosh on, it's going to be a little bit ugly. I got to tell you something. They could, in fact, do so because they are against, you know, continually spending their money and continually spending the Germans' money on the bailouts of Spain, Portugal, Greece, etc., Italy. And it would be actually momentarily very ugly for markets and bonds and all that. But I think that the realization of what they set up at the ECB by buying the bonds under 3 years would, you know, at least hold things up a bit. Germany doesn't want Greece to exit because it would cost them a tremendous amount of money, about $70 billion it would cost them. And cause just a messy situation. They really don't want anybody to exit, but at the same time, they don't want anybody to stay either, because either way, it's going to cost them a heap of money. The question is, how much of a hardcore tact are they going to take on this? Because we already know that much of the money that was pledged by Merkel was they shook the hand and said, you know, you really shouldn't be doing that. You don't have the right to do that. You don't have the right to spend our money. And it's the equivalent of President Obama just going out and saying, hey, we'll give you $100 billion without congressional approval. There's limits. So we're going to see on the 12th what happens there. I don't even want to handicap what's going to happen. I have no idea. And frankly, I'm not sure where this is going to go. If you were to, you know, hold a gun to my head and say, like, what are they going to do? I would have to say that for the sake of the potential continuation of the euro region and the euro as a currency, that they're going to have to cave on this, but come out with some very hard line about any future monies that will be spent. And at the same time, kind of shake a finger at the fact that they, you know, all, everybody's doing the wrong thing, et cetera, but it is constitutional. They need to make a stand that says that they're against it, but yet at the same time approve it. That makes sense? I just don't think that they're going to do anything to rock the boat at this point, because we're still on very thin ice when it comes to the overall economic situation there. We see them, again, forget about their stock market for a second, because there's a total bifurcation of the stock market, or dislocation of the stock market and the economies. Last week we saw that the euro region hit an all-time high as far as the region was concerned in terms of unemployment. We saw that their manufacturing numbers were down, their ISM numbers were down. I mean, just everything is looking uglier and uglier. Now, whether or not there's going to be some sentiment change and all of a sudden there's going to be a change in what's happening in the countries from a manufacturing and economic standpoint because of this bond buying, I'd have to doubt it, because you're going to continue with the austerity measures. Kind of taking with one hand and giving with the other. So there'll be a sentiment change, but still with the austerity measures that's happening, I'm not sure how much that's really going to affect it. The other thing that's happening on the 12th, you know it, Apple is going to be theoretically, possibly, at least speculatively, announcing their iPhone 5. What that's going to be meaning to everybody, and if everybody's going to line up and they're going to make a big hoo-ha about this, there is a lot of discussion that there's going to be a lot of movement from people who had other phones finally into this. Because they were waiting for this after the iPhone 4S was kind of a middle step into the next generation of iPhone. We'll see what happens with that. But it is possible also that they can be announcing an iPad mini. Or a mini pad, as some people say. And I think one other interesting thing I want to talk about before we end the show and move on to some other things into next week is, have you watched the gun makers recently, Sturm Ruger and Smith & Wesson? Smith & Wesson came out with earnings last week on Friday. Stock was up about 13-14%. And the day before that, actually, there was a big move on both these companies. Smith & Wesson had a little bit more of a move. Sturm Ruger was up, I think, 5.5%, 6% or so, and Smith & Wesson was up 8% on the fact that there was a 28% increase in FBI checks for people who want to buy guns. Now, we talked about this a few weeks ago after the terrible tragedy that we saw on the midnight showing of Batman and that horrible situation there. And we knew that there was going to be the potential for the outcry for people for gun control. But at the same time, we said, wait a minute, let's think about this for a second. Let's think logically. Let's think about what's going to happen here. There's going to be this big outcry, and what is going to happen is people, this is kind of like an inflation discussion, people are going to say, wait a minute, you know what? I've been thinking about a gun for a while. There's going to be some possible new legislation, regulations out. Maybe what I should do is I should go out and I should get a gun now. And that's exactly what happened. Now, whether it was because they want to get protection because of the situation, whether it's because they've been thinking about it for a while and they said, you know what, now's a good time to do it because of the situation, or they said, you know what, I better do it now because if I don't do it now, who knows when I'm going to be able to do it again if, in fact, there is some additional gun control that comes in. Whatever the fact, I want you to think about that, and I want you to think about that and in relation to the discussion we had a little while ago with regard to inflation. The big demon that is haunting the Fed is the idea of deflation. With deflation, which is just a horrible thing, because what happens is people wait to do things. They figure, hey, you know what? Prices are going down. I don't have to worry about this because, you know what? Over time, whether it's now or a month or 6 months later, the price will probably be lower, so I'm in no rush to do it. They'll put it on sale. Don't worry about it. And what happens is inventories build, discounts go on, sales don't happen, and they have to get rid of their merchandise to sell it, and they have to do so at lower prices, and this kind of feeds upon itself. Now, when you have a situation that brews where you have a situation where, okay, you know, I see prices are moving up, or supply is thinning out, or maybe some law is going to come into place that I can't get it. People hate to say that I can't get it. They go out and get it. And this is why I'm saying that when it comes to the Fed, they should really start thinking, in my opinion, about reversing the logic on investors. Make them go out and do something, not believe that you're going to keep interest rates low forever. Make them go out and say, you know what, I'm going to refinance now. I'm going to go buy the house now. I'm going to lock in the price now. I'm going to do something, because what they're doing now is creating, in my opinion, their own deflationary measure because of the way that they're creating the stance on what they're going to do. The gun situation, I think, clearly shows that. It's a massive increase in FBI checks and background checks, and that turned into really good profits for Smith & Wesson, and is going to turn into decent profits, it seems, for Sturm Ruger. RGR, that's a stock we actually own. I think we alerted that on Trigger Points, Trigger Point Research, not too long ago. And by the way, just as a side note, TriggerPointResearch.com. You get instant stock quotes, alerts. If a stock is moving up, these are screened. These are qualified, and there's a high confidence rating before these are released. Maybe get one or two in a day. Maybe get none for 3 days. Maybe get five in a week. Both short and long, depending on which package you take, it's very inexpensive. And if you can't make money from one of the transactions, one of the alerts that pays for your entire month worth of subscription fees, I'd be very surprised. We've got some great feedback on this, and there's a 14-day free trial. So go over to TriggerPointResearch.com, TriggerPointResearch.com, to get your 14-day free trial. That just seemed to work right with there. Sorry about that. I thought it was good. But if you haven't done so, you really, you know, it's time to do so. But Sturm Ruger is a great company. Look at the stock chart on that. It's done very, very well. And it's in a time when people are looking for greater protection, greater opportunity to make sure they lock in. And it's kind of like the inflation trade that I think should go on with what the Fed should do. So there you have it. We see gold higher. We see silver higher. We see oil has been moving higher. That's probably going to come back a little bit. I would see that, say there's going to be a little back and fill here. You know, you get the gold moving up very dramatically. And I would venture to say, unless something very dramatically is announced to the contrary, there's probably be a sell the news situation happening probably on Thursday of this week. Keep a watch on that. The VIX is very low right now. We've talked about that before. We have been moving around. We moved forward the VIX. We have some losses on the last VIX trade, but of course we got the gains on the long portfolio. But we're not giving up right now on the VIX because we think the VIX is really telling a different story than reality right now in the markets. Even though there is a big helping hand by central banks, and it's more than a big helping hand, it's a gigantic shizzle of help that they're giving out. Let me segue. I got a couple of emails in. I got a lot of emails in here. Let's see here. I want to pick one of them to read here. All right. This is an email that came in. And by the way, if you want to contact me, just send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And this is a email by Gabby. And Gabby says, I love your podcast. Give me a lot of measures and great ideas on investing. I have a question about a do-it-yourself hedge fund. And not sure if you talked about it before. Is it possible to create my own hedge fund just from two ETFs such as SPY and a single inverse S&P 500 such as SH? If I just buy them in equal amounts, kind of defeat the purpose. And I might lose some money, as one gains would cancel the other one's loss and vice versa. However, in a bullish trend, I could weigh SPY to something, say, as 80% and give SH only 20%. That way, a 10% drop in SPY would only translate to 8%. It could be flipped to a bearish trend when SPY of 20% and 80% of SH. And a flat trend holding cash would be the best option. Have you come across this option, and would it be a good idea, and maybe not just doing this with a Dow Jones and all that? Gabby, I got to tell you something. I don't understand the point of this. Why would you have, for example, in a bull trend, why would you have an 80-20? Why don't you just have, and if you look into net out 60, just have 60 in. I don't understand what it would be to have two investments in there. It costs you less money to have one versus the other. In a bull trend, if you're just using, if you're trying to do it this way, go 100% in a bull trend into S&P 500. That's what you would do. And you would take off as things possibly got a little bit higher, and you would reverse it as you see the trend change. The question is, when is the trend going to, you know, be in either a consolidation? When is the trend going to be in a in an uptrend, and when is it going to be a downtrend? That's what you have to figure out. Once you figure out that, there's no reason to do this. There's no reason to have 20% S&P and 80% SA. I mean, it just nets itself out. There's no reason to do that. You just have one versus the other. You want to be in 60%? Be in 60%, not 80-20 that nets out 20 from the other. It doesn't make any sense. Usually what a hedge fund does, they don't just hedge the same instrument. That's, I think, where you're getting it wrong here. And you're on the right track with this, but this is what they would do. Something like this. They would say, you know what? In the S&P 500, I like that, fine. But you know what? It looks like there's going to be a relational trade, a spread trade, where the, as an example, the Russell 2000 is going to be a little bit weaker. Again, this is just an idea. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put 80% in the S&P 500, but I'm going to short 20% of the Russell 2000. Or, for example, I'm going to do a different trade. I'm going to say, you know what? The better trade is to be right now in a defensive posture, so I'm going to be in the S&P 500. I'm going to add to it from utilities and telecoms and healthcare, but I'm going to short materials and I'm going to short technology, as an example. Okay? So what you want to do is not exactly have the identical instrument being short and long. You want to have different instruments, but that have a relationship, but you can see which one is going to play better in a spread trade or in a relational trade. I hope that answers that. Anyway, any questions you have, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And no question is good, bad, ugly, too dumb, too smart. Gabby's question was great because I think Gabby's on the right track. Just a little bit of a guidance, a little bit of a maneuvering of the same question in a different way answered for some more clarity. I'll be happy to answer it at any time. I want to thank you for joining me. We do have some great guests coming up. I know that I think I'm going to be on Frank Curzio's show next week or the week after. We have Mark Faber coming on from the Gloom Doom Report. We have Das coming up. We're going to have McClellan coming up again because he has some great things on the presidential cycles. There's lots of things going on. And some other guests that we are contacting because you asked us to do so. We're going to have some of the gang from Fast Money on CNBC. All sorts of things coming up. Please make sure to visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com because that's where you get your weekly dose of all this. And, of course, you get some of the stock ideas that we have that are going on here and over at triggerpointresearch.com. Thanks for joining me. Appreciate it. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.